Get ready for the Ocelli Effect. Ocelli.
19th day of February 2016, and this is the Ocelli Effect broadcast live on American Freedom Radio at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Also, we do have a player at Ocelli.com, which is my website that simply, when you press play, turns on American Freedom Radio so you can listen to myself or anybody else who is on the network. That's the way it goes. There's lots of websites that actually carry the American Freedom Radio web player at this point, and we do appreciate every last one of you, especially those of you who do decide to tune in later. Check us out further on down the stream. Pick up the archives at American Freedom Radio. Every last one of you is appreciated. I almost felt like starting out the show today by barking. Telling you, I still find that extremely hysterical, the whole thing with Hillary Clinton barking. That's some funny stuff. But, hey, it gets even stranger and stranger. Now, my guest tonight is, Brother Gregory Williams. I'm gonna bring him in, via the phone. So, not exactly the way I usually like to do this, but it is the best way to get about it. And I'm gonna tell you something. Brother Gregory is a fascinating character. This is weird because I usually don't have too many callers on the line, and I didn't give out the phone number or anything, and I've got a couple of them, so let's see who's who here. All right. Is that you, Brother Gregory? Hello? All right. Let's put that one back on hold. Is that you, Brother Gregory?
Yes, it is.
Ah, okay. I have my phone lines crossed up in front of me, and I wasn't sure who was who there. see, this is what happens when you let a blind guy run a switchboard. Okay. So, I was starting to introduce you, and I didn't even get to it, but I wanted to make sure I had you on the line because I was a little confused. Here's the thing about Brother Gregory. I've got to say this. I usually don't find very much useful when I have talked to anybody who is even remotely related to the Catholic Church. And I confided this in you off the air, I think, that this is one of those things that I never find to be a useful discussion in any way, shape, or form. But here's the truth. In a very short time, speaking to this gentleman, I found a lot of what he had to say, not only relevant, but extremely enlightening, okay? Just to the point of, I don't even know how to explain it. It was just like I was hearing tons of things that I knew to be truth, and I was actually hearing it from someone who had gone through the trouble of studying in a very deep way, not only the biblical text, so to speak, but also religion in general. He had an extremely diversified worldview. There was nothing close-minded I heard, and all I heard was extremely, I don't know, revealing information that you normally don't get from anybody. Okay? This gentleman is an author. You've got to look him up, and now I'm trying to look for the website directly in front of me, but it is, wow. You know, here's where things go wrong right in front of me when I'm trying to do stuff here. You were suggested to me by a gentleman named Mark. That was the first thing. And I thought it was a rather strange suggestion. But after I got to speak to you and start to look over your material, I think that that it goes way beyond even those who would be seeking religious enlightenment or instruction or anything like that. A lot of the things that you have to say are universally just amazing and enlightening. Now, that sounds like a real generalized statement. How is it that you would explain yourself? Because when we started talking about, you know, how it is I would introduce you on the show and everything, it's kind of a deep story. How would you introduce yourself to the listeners who are going, why does he have a guy on named Brother Gregory?
Well, the Brother Gregory, my name is, of course, Gregory Williams, and Williams is the most popular name in the United States. And there's a lot of Gregory Williams, and I actually had people pay to go and hear me talk and found out it was a different Gregory Williams. There's all kinds of us out there. And so I started, some people started calling me Brother Gregory, and that made me a little bit more unique when somebody Googled me, but now there's several Brother Gregories out there. So, you know, it just kind of stuck. It's not an official title or anything, but there's an awful lot of people who just know me by Brother Gregory. And so that's how that nomenclature came about. But, you know, who I am, yeah, I you know, I'm an old guy. I've done a lot of things. I've studied a lot of things. I happen to have access to a lot of information the average guy doesn't have access to. And there isn't probably a topic that I can't talk on that I don't become controversial rather quickly with somebody. You know, it'll take a while to get I don't know if you can put me in a capsule. So you'll just have to listen to the whole show and find out.
Well, see, that was the point. I couldn't figure out a way. Look, I can normally give you in a few sentences or a paragraph something, a summation of an individual so that you have points of reference that make sense, you know, basically where they're going to go and what they're discussing. But the truth is, in having this discussion with you off the air, no matter what I said and no matter what direction we went in, you absolutely had something extremely enlightened to say. It wasn't restricted to any set of dogmatic beliefs that I've ever heard somebody speaking from. Although, I mean, quite technically, I mean, you are studied in a particular religious discipline. I mean, maybe you can explain that.
I was studying in the Roman Catholic Church. Originally, it was a Carmelite rite. But then by the time I began my studies to become a Catholic priest, I was studying in a Roman rite directly under the auspices of the Pope. In a seminary out in California, which is since, you know, the actual place where we attended college or school, burned down and was destroyed. But, the seminary that I was attending was up on the hill above that. And I was only 13 years old. So this is back in the early 60s. And, it was Catholic in origin. I knew people who lived in the Vatican. But I'm not really a Catholic I'm probably Catholic hierarchy's worst nightmare, because I'm willing to tell you what they have tried to keep a secret for 1,000 years or more.
So, yeah, that was the thing. When I started to discuss certain things with you, which, quite honestly, any time that I have broached the subject with others who are priests or are involved in the church in some way, I usually get a pretty violent reaction, some of the things that I kind of threw at you. And I did that on purpose, just to see what would happen. I do that on occasion. Sometimes I say things, not, you know, I ask a question not necessarily to get an answer, but to get a reaction. And I did that, and I got to tell you, there was no wincing about it. You just very, very well handled certain things and didn't have that kind of adverse reaction that I was used to. So I was first stunned by that, because no matter if someone has begun to, engage in these types of studies, you know, I would call them studies of the cloth, I guess, where you're going to become a priest or you're going to go into any one of the orders, which get very confusing to me anyway. I find that no matter what, the rest of their lives, they have a high sensitivity to certain discussions, and you are absolutely fearless in the discussion, which is something I never observe. So I wanted to get to that because, I mean, obviously you were very serious about this, and you had taken some time, and you were going to devote your life to it. And, you know, meanwhile, this is just me discussing why you're called Brother Gregory, mind you.
So. Well, the Brother Gregory came much, much later. Pretty much I had realized the error of, you know, that is all laced throughout the hierarchy of the Roman Church. I mean, your average priest, your average person who goes to a Catholic church, they have no idea what goes on behind the scenes or what's been said. There's very few of them have any knowledge of the Bible. And again, you're talking about, you know, the Catholicism is a huge, gigantic mishmash of lots of different ideas. If you go to different countries, Catholicism is quite different. But I was pretty much done with all that by the time I was 17 and, you know, completely out of the educational system. But I had some very interesting, it's given me a lot of insight by going through that and meeting the different people that I met and the different challenges that I met during that process was simply preparing me. That's what my whole life seems to have been. Is preparing. My father was an attorney, not just your average everyday attorney. He wrote law books. Mm-hmm. You know, so I had access to information that a lot of people would not normally have access to. And I felt like now when I look back that all those different experiences were a part of my training, where I really began to become public and start writing these books and all this stuff. I was actually a sheep herder out on the high deserts of Oregon. So I've run the gamut. I've been in law enforcement, carried a gun and a badge for a living. I've been property managers. I've been bookkeeper. I've been a forest ranger. You know, I've done all these different jobs, but every one of them was preparing me for what, you know, I'm offering people now. And it's controversial, but if anybody who reads our books, which are all free online, there's 700 to 800 footnotes in every single book because I don't want people just to believe me. I want to prove what I'm saying so that they have some sort of reference. But anyway, you can't get me on a 3x5 card. But
no, absolutely not. And you know what? I couldn't put your book. I picked up one of the books. Okay, I'll be honest with you. Just one, and because I wanted to give it some attention, that's a covenant of the gods. And this book can't be put on a 3x5 card. And I'm hoping that we can sort of focus on that tonight because it's I really need about 20 straight hours with you to get at everything that we could discuss, I think. But let's try and focus in that area because, okay, a lot of people would think that this is just going to be part of the, part of the typical dogmatic presentation. And, I mean, I even made a statement to you about the Catholic Church in general that I felt as though it was probably one of the most pagan things, the way it's been presented to me on the planet, because of the conglomeration of so many different rituals and ritualizations that aren't even based in their own literature. It's very interesting. It has, so that to me in and of itself, usually if somebody's spent any time in the church and has had a profound understanding of it, they're usually revolted by statements like that I make. And you weren't. You just kind of went, well, you know, I understand why you're saying that. And, you know, it just, we went forward with this discussion where, And it was remarkable to me. So I had to read the book. I had to start on it, but I find myself rereading different parts of it. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind just kind of helping me break it down for the listener a little bit. And we'll certainly point people to the website so they can find this material as we go here. But I want to just kind of give people an audio understanding, like an introduction to what goes on in this one book, because I think that this is extremely important and worthwhile for anybody to who is in the pursuit of, well, the reality which has been thusly pulled over our eyes at this point in time, you know, in order to obscure the truth right? That's what I see. I think that this is an extremely great tool, and I'd like to give people an idea of what's in it.
Oh, well, that's actually the first book that I wrote, and I've been originally you talked about, like, you wanted to talk about money. And so that's what I've been telling everybody, but it doesn't matter because even in the book I talk about money. So,
we'd get around to that because that was my initial idea with you. And when it was first presented to me by a third party to talk to you, I thought it would be great because we could examine, the concept of charity and what the Ubuntu project and what a completely different idea about exchanges and how trade could be had among people could be universally shifted overnight if there was just a change in understanding. And I thought that's where I was going with you. But as I started to read your material and I had that pretty lengthy conversation with you, it really gave me a totally different sense of what I needed to do first time out. And by the way, I hope I can do this with you more than once, and we'll get to various specific topics, actually. So this is just one, you know.
the first chapter of the book, Covenants of the Gods, and every word that we use needs almost to be redefined because every word we use has already been redefined. And so what we're really doing, what I'm really often trying to do, is tell you what the definition used to be. If you were to study the Constitution of the United States, you'd want to use a Bouvier's Law Dictionary because that was the dictionary that was connected to the people who were writing the Constitution at that time. So you have to know what words meant when they wrote down that agreement. The same is true with the Bible. You have to know what words meant at the time of Jesus Christ. What was really going on? You talk about the Roman Church having all these pagan rituals, and I've seen the books. I know the author of some of the most popular books on that subject. But the reality is the pagan is not a single term that just refers to one group of people. It refers to all kinds of different people and what they were doing. The concept of holy matrimony versus marriage, which is the first chapter of the book, which is the first thing that I wrote. And I could tell you stories how I even started to write this book and what divine events took place out on the desert that brought me to the point where I'm all of a sudden trying to write a book on law. And where was I going to get my resources? Well, as soon as I began to realize this, a stack of law books showed up on my doorstep. I mean, it was like, one day I make a realization, the next day the books are stacked up, I'm almost 3 feet high, on my door front, out here in the middle of the desert. I come in with my work boots on and I'm paging through law books, last thing I thought I would be looking at.
Right, and I gotta say, that's one of those things that I hear commonly when someone writes something that's extremely profound. They were generally kind of, the conditions present themselves.
Right.
Some people might describe it as providence, right? That, whatever you want to call it, if you want to say God, the gods, if you want to say the universe, whatever it is you want to call it, somehow or other you seem to be positioned in such a way that it's inevitable that you need to create this thing that you envisioned, and it just simply comes to fruition by almost what seems to be happenstance, as opposed to a plan or anything like that. Things just drop in your lap, so to speak.
A common occurrence in my life. Like I said, things that what I call Kodak moments as I was growing up and experiencing things. When I first went to get the marriage license, that my wife and I went and got back, and whenever we got married in the 73, I think it was, and I asked them, why do we have to get a license to get married? I said, I understood, because when I went to get my driver's license, my father, an attorney, is teaching me to drive, and I said, why do you have to get a license to drive? And he actually was kind of set back by the question, but these are actually what I call Kodak moments. Something was nagging in me, trying to figure out things, even way back then. And, of course, their answer at the marriage license, well, it's just a matter of record. But in reality, it's not. And so I ended up writing this chapter, Holy Matrimony versus Marriage. It's pretty much the same that I wrote back then, many, many, many years ago. First thing I did after I put it together in a pamphlet form is I took it to my father, and I gave it to him to read. And I said, you know, read this and tell me what you think. And this is a guy who's wrote law books, you know, highest score ever on the Texas bar exam. I mean, he dealt with international law. He's dealt with all kinds of different areas of the law. And so he's reading this little pamphlet that I put together on matrimony, different versus marriage, holy matrimony versus marriage. And he comes back. He asked me one question. I answered the question, and he said, you're right, but they're not going to like you. And now, who's not going to like me? Lawyers, judges, government people, people who control the things of the world. And he explained to me in a brief story why this was going to be. That marriage is a contract. When you go down and get a marriage license, you're entering into a contract with the state, a three-party contract that's giving away rights and powers over that union that you cannot get back once you do that, at least not easily get back. And it's a way to bring you into bondage. The reality is that when you study this farther, and we don't go into all this in the book, all these chapters are about 5,000 words. The whole book is 144 pages long. And the chapters go through marriage, you know, holy matrimony versus marriage, law versus legal, citizen versus citizen, employee versus enslaved, God versus government. The Bible mentions religion 5 times. It mentions government almost 700 times, contracts hundreds and hundreds of times. It says, make no contracts, the covenants with them, nor with their gods. And the word God in both Old and New Testament were commonly used when those books were being written in reference to judges and magistrates in courts of law. When you go down and get a marriage license, you're making a contract with the gods of your government. Or whatever government you go to, whether you go to Italian government or Australian government, you're making contracts and you're waiving rights and you're going under authorities.
Right. Now, I always found this interesting, and I'll tell you from somebody who at certain points in my life has described myself as an atheist, although that was incorrect. You know, I've described myself as spiritual, and that's incorrect as well. You know, I've described myself in several different ways. I don't adhere to any particular set of religious rules. I hate to even use the word religious, because anything that's religious to me is just a repetitive action. It doesn't actually mean that it has any sort of spiritual substance, but let's just use it for the sake of terminology here. You know, but even looking at it from that perspective, I always found it rather odd that you would require a license and that this was a merger and that really it was more of a business arrangement. And people think that's sort of a jaded statement, and you'd expect it coming from me because I've been married a couple of times. But, you know, the thing is, it is a business arrangement. That's what it is. But I think what is highly misunderstood, which is something that you explain, is that truthfully, you have a third partner here. It's not a matter of just forming a partnership in a legal sense and for convenience and et cetera, there's actually a little more to it. And
there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, well, right. There's a lot more to it. And I want you to explain it that way, because this is something that's being missed. Yeah, when we talk about gods and how they describe gods in the text, quite often we are talking about judges, and this does make a lot of sense when you reevaluate the terminology later on. You take a look back at some of those sentences. Now they begin to make a whole lot more sense when you insert the word judge in your mind. But what's fascinating is that I think people don't even recognize the depth that it goes to when you're choosing to become married. I mean, it doesn't matter if the justice of the peace does it, or you know, or if the local, whichever guy at whichever building that they call a church does it. It doesn't really matter. The fact is that this is actually an extremely complex and rather binding contract. You know,
right.
So I wonder.
Yeah, marriage has always been a contract. Even the word marriage comes from a Latin word, maritium, which had to do with making a contract. It was to get married. But who you went to, who was the authority of that contract? It used to be the parents. You went and asked your father for permission to get married. Even Samson went to his father to get permission to get married. But mm-hmm. now you go to the state to get permission because literally the state is your father. This same controversy of holy matrimony versus marriage was a controversy at the time of Augustus Caesar and Jesus Christ. And there were people who were dealing with this same issue of getting a marriage license from the state. Even the word maritium was first used by Justinian in the Justinian Codes to create a licensed relationship that is not under the law of nature, but under the codes of Rome. Marriage or matrimony, we call it holy matrimony, you could call it lots of different things, is a natural relationship. And we go through the chapter and we show you that here, you know, the union of a man and a woman is a natural relationship. It's a binding of those two people, and they can do it themselves. Karl Marx, when he got married, he just made out a contract, and him and his wife signed it, and they were married. They didn't go down to a justice of the peace and get it filed with the government. Although, by that time, most unions of marriage, even though you made the contract up yourselves, would be adjudicated in a civil court. Well, why was that? Because if you go back a little farther in history, that's not where it would be adjudicated. It would not be adjudicated in a civil court. It would be adjudicated in an ecclesiastical court or a common law court. But it was the brother to Marie Antoinette who was the king in Austria, who first started saying, well, marriage from now on is going to be a civil agreement. Everybody didn't jump on that at one time, but that's where people were moving in that direction. And, of course, that was a time of the French Revolution, and lots of things were starting to run under civil courts rather than common law courts. In America, common law courts were still reigning. But now I throw out words like common law courts, and people think, well, I want to have my stuff in a common law court. But they don't know all the little ins and outs of these things. And this is what the book is trying. Like, all these chapters were originally like 70-page books, and I condensed them down to 12 to 15-page books and put them there in one single book. And
right. And the information
in a particular style.
Yeah, no, the information is extremely dense, and there is a, you know, and I do mean that in a positive way. It's extremely dense, and I actually really appreciate the style in which you put it, which, by the way, just for the listener's clarification, if we take a look back at the Roman Emperor Justinian, this is the guy who was most often accredited with delivering what they called the moral code of law to the Roman Empire. And kind of fascinating side note to that, he also is a guy who married a stripper. But I always find that funny because I love Roman history, because Roman history tells us a lot about the ebb and flow of today's society in one way or another. I do believe that we are under a sort of plagiarized Greek system to this day, which, of course, is what the Roman system was in a lot of ways. And the tentacles of that go rather far. Of course, that has nothing to do with what we're discussing now.
Can. You know, when you look at Roman history, Roman history is around 800 to 900 years long. When it first began, what we see is Roman history, when they established Rome the Republic, that was 500 years before Christ. And they did it by literally a revolutionary war where they threw out the kings, the Tarquinian kings, and set up what they called a republic. They actually fashioned it after the an earlier republic that we know of as Israel. That was one of the earliest republics, was Israel. There were no kings in Israel. There was no one. It wasn't a democracy. It was a republic. It wasn't an indirect democracy. It was a republic. The leaders were titular. All these things, people don't even know what a republic is today. And, of course, we have a chapter, Republic versus Democracy, and Democracy versus Demagogue. So we go into these things so that you understand that when you say the word republic, when are you talking about it? Are you talking Libera Res Publica, free from things public? Or res publica, things public. And by the time Augustus came along, the Roman Republic was dead. They were still calling it one, but it really became a democracy. You talk about gods. There were three offices Augustus held after their civil war. They had a civil war, not a revolutionary war, a civil war in which the first emperor, Augustus Caesar, who was really named Octavius, that was his real name. Augustus is a title. Caesar was a title. But he had three offices. And this is really enlightening, so you can understand how history is repeating itself. One was Principas Civitas, which means first citizen.
Right.
His wife was known as Principas Femina, the first lady. That would be translated first lady. That office was the chief executive office of Rome, a municipality. He had another office that he held, which was imperator. That translates, Collins Latin Dictionary, commander-in-chief, because he was the commander-in-chief of the army and the navy. That was a 10-year term of office. He had to run for office. Most people didn't know this. Caesar was elected by the Senate, which was an electoral college. But the third office is the most enlightening, which tells you a little bit about this book, which was apotheos is one pronunciation. It's a Greek word originally. It means originator of gods. Well, what was his duties as originator of gods? He appointed all the imperial judges in courts of law to decide imperial matters throughout the empire. He appointed the Supreme Court that would hear these cases that if they were finally appealed upwards into Roman proper, he appointed them. So what is he doing? He's doing exactly what the President of the United States does. Commander-in-chief. Chief Executive Officer of Washington, D.C., and the appointer of judges throughout the federal empire.
See, I was just going to say, doesn't that sound familiar?
Not only that, the Capitol Dome, the picture painted in the Capitol Dome is titled as the Apotheos of Washington. That title was given to that painting by Constantine Bermudi, who was sent over by the Pope to paint the Capitol Dome's picture. You can go in there today and look up there. You can go online, look it up, Capitol Dome, Constantine Bermudi, and look at that picture. On the U.S. government website, it says it raises Washington to the rank of God. That's what the painting does. Says that on the U.S. government website. I've got clips on our website that show you those pictures. Because he is the appointer of judges who rule over you, who tell you what is good and what is evil, what is right and what is wrong. You don't live in a republic anymore. You live in an indirect democracy. And in reality, you have returned to the bondage of Egypt. You have done all these things by making covenants, contracts, with these institutions which you have created with the works of your own hands, and you are now back. You are no longer free people. You're back into bondage. Mm-hmm. And the only way back is to change the way you think. You can elect anybody you want. That's fine with me. But it's not going to change anything. You have to change the way you think. And that's what repentance means. It means think a different way, to change one's mind. And that's where we're taking people. People won't believe all this. You know, we're hearing me in a few minutes here. But that's why there's 15 chapters in that book where we take you through step by step, including money versus mammon. I already mentioned republic and employment versus enslaved. You know, in Israel, what was the bondage of Egypt? The bondage of Egypt is all the gold and silver belonged to the government. All the land belonged to the government. And you had to work at least 20% of every year for the government. And of course, the government was called Pharaoh. It wasn't called federal, but in reality, you were a Pharaoh employee or a federal employee. And that was the bondage of Egypt. But they had a ceiling limit. They could only take 20%. Well, heck, your Social Security payment now is 14% plus. And then you have income tax on top of that, property tax on top of that. And through crafts of state, they are taking way more. Until just recently, when Mubarak was still president of Egypt, you didn't pay any more than 20% income tax in Egypt. If you made $1 million, you paid 20%. If you made $100 million, you paid 20%, because it was still law in Egypt that you couldn't take more than that. In Australia, they can take 57% just in income tax alone. So you're in a bondage worse than it was in Egypt. And we're in that bondage because we don't understand what Jesus Christ was actually talking about. We don't understand what Moses was actually doing. And we don't, because we don't know the meaning of words and we don't know history. And so that's what that book is about.
We also don't know the meaning of symbols, because I'll tell you what else I observe. Which I'm going to throw this in there, and I'm very sure you're going to know where to put this. The fact is that if you take a look at the Statue of Liberty, if you consider that the District of Columbia and those things, and including the Lady Justice, who is blindfolded and has scales, you know, these things are all reminiscent of goddess religions. And it seems to me as though there is quite a bit of tribute paid to those goddess religions via these symbols that are held over us. It is not just the Roman symbol in and of itself, but I mean, you actually have the goddesses being implemented into the system as well. What do you think of that?
Well, more so than people even realize at all. I mean, that long after the Statue of Liberty was created and built, someone unearthed this authentically. I mean, they dug it up, unearthed a tablet, pretty good sized tablet. I mean, it's, you know, like 2 feet tall. And it was a stone carved out of stone, and it was normally put as a relief up on a building. And it is the spitting image of the symbol that we see as the Statue of Liberty. And yet it's been buried for thousands of years in Iraq. Mm-hmm. How come that symbol actually show up again? And I can show you all kinds, but I actually know guys who've written books on these things. I knew about it before. One of my pastimes is archaeology and interest in ancient symbols and stuff. But it isn't. The symbols are going to show up, and it's part of this quantum spirituality that keeps flowing through generation after generation. History does repeat itself. We do go back. The dog returns to its vomit. And I don't give power to symbols. I know they're going to show up. I know where they're coming from. The real power is the power behind that, which is a spiritual power. And I can tell you why people are in bondage today. I can tell you where this is going to lead. There's going to be a decline and fall of the Roman Empire. just again, but we now it's the U.S. empire. We already see the declining taking place, and there's going to be a fall, and it's going to collapse. And millions of people are going to die, more so than in the collapse of the Roman Empire.
Oh, right. And we see there's many parallels to be had, too, because, okay, the expansion of the U.S. military empire across the planet, I mean, we're currently present in something like, at a minimum, 160 of 180-something nations, according to my last count. Of course, that can change somewhat week to week based on the fact that some places, you know, emerge and disappear as nations on the planet. But truthfully speaking, I mean, we are in nearly every single nation. We have an outpost, very much like the Roman Empire did across the known world, had an outpost in just about every single nation.
127 different nations. Rome had outposts.
Yeah. We've actually done better.
They were the policemen of the world. That's what the Pax Romana was.
Right.
It is the exact same thing. And I can actually take you back in history under Tutankhamun, which goes back way back to the time of Moses, which was the pharaoh that was actually throwing the Israelites out. He was doing the same thing. He had his jurisdiction was way off. He had bases all the way to Canaan. But now our bases go all the way around the world. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. We are primed for the absolute most destructive, cataclysmic destruction of society that you can imagine, from Europe to China and everything in between. But during the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, what the real Christians were doing, which is much different than what we see Christians doing today, they thrived. Even with persecution, they were thriving. What we need to do is find out what they were doing, which is why I wrote another book, Thy Kingdom Comes, so that people, and another book, The Free Church Report, which has a picture of Lady Godiva on the front of our Free Church Report. So that gets people's curiosity up. And all these books are available online for free. You don't have to sign up anything. You just have to find them. They're there. And we have several websites where you can find them. But what we're trying to do is show you the underlying forces that moves whole societies to pick up the same symbols, to create the same governmental structures. You talk about religion, and you were using the term, and I understand where you get that definition of the term, but if you went back 200 years and looked up the definition of religion in, say, Bouvier's, a law dictionary, religion, it's the performance of your duty to God and your fellow man. That's what the definition was. What's your duty to your fellow man? According to God, it's to love thy neighbor as thyself. To you know, if your neighbor falls in a ditch, you help him get out. If somebody beats him up, you come to his protection. If somebody tries to rape your neighbor, you go to his protection. That's your duty, to love your neighbor as yourself, to care about his rights as much as you care about your own. But instead, in our society, we have people who go to church and say they're praying to God, but then when they go home, they apply to men who call themselves benefactors, will give them welfare, unemployment, health care, Social Security, by going to their neighbor's house and forcing their neighbors to contribute to their welfare. That is anti-Christ. That is anti-Moses. That is coveting your neighbor's goods. That is against the Ten Commandments. But everybody who goes to church thinks that's okay. It's okay to force my neighbor so that I can have free education, free public schools, free health care. They think that's okay. And that's why their society is on a fast track to destruction. And to change your thinking, to realize, hey, I've got to stop looking to the fathers of the earth, you know, that was another thing Jesus said, call no man father. We have a chapter on that. But he says, call no man father. He uses a Greek word that is in that Greek text, you actually see a Latin word that is also used in the Greek, that the languages would use certain words over each other. But it was patri, which means father. At that time, all the senators of Rome were addressed Father Cicero, patri Seneca, patri Tacitus. That's the way they addressed them. And he's saying, call no man patri. Everybody in the crowd, when Jesus said that, knew he was talking about the Senate of Rome and the Emperor of Rome. Excuse me. He was saying, don't look to them for your benefits. Don't pray to them for your benefits. Those are the men he calls the benefactors who exercise authority. He says it wasn't to be that way with us. And that's what Christians learn to do without those benefits. They learn to take care of one another. And this created a union and discipline based on faith, hope, and charity that made them, actually, the Roman emperors like Antonius Pius and Marcus Aurelius, they feared Christians. Very peaceful people, not going to hurt anybody, well-armed as people go in those days. But they were out there helping society, taking up the slack because the Roman benefits were decreasing rapidly as the government was going bankrupt. You're going to see that in the next few years. You're already seeing it where the benefits are not covering the costs and expenses. How are people going to survive?
Right. We're already seeing that. And that's one of the fascinating things because, look, I have tried to say, and meanwhile, I'm not coming at this from the angle of, you know, of any particular text driving what I'm saying or any particular discipline or religion or whatever it is you wish to call it. I simply have this belief that universally, if we were to show kindness to one another, if we were to literally take care of one another, we could literally live in a responsible state of what they describe as anarchy, which is to literally mean without a leader, okay? We could live in that state if we had an attitude change here. And everybody thinks I'm nuts. I mean, you know, I must have, you know, fallen down the hippie hole here when it comes to it, because I do believe that, honestly, if we learned once again, because I do believe this happened in history at certain points, that you took care of your neighbors, you took care of each other, there was no need to do this through a surrogate, which was the government. There was no need to do this through anything else. I mean, I've seen churches on rare occasions do this, right? But for the most part, those institutions don't do it. Generally speaking, although they talk about doing it a lot, they don't really take care of a lot of people. But if we as individuals learned to exchange things in a way that wasn't based on placing them on a scale, that wasn't based upon a fictitious value system, if we simply took care of each other, it would actually change everything. It would not be a matter of the haves and have-nots and scarcity and things like that. It would all become irrelevant. And quite honestly, it would change the trajectory of the society in general. You would have far less violence, far less need for the escapism of drugs, a whole lot less of a need to test one's limits in a lot of things that people might describe as perversions. I think a lot of these things would absolutely evaporate if we could readjust ourselves in a spiritual way, and, you know, stop me if I'm crazy here, if we could readjust ourselves in a spiritual way to simply take care of one another and consider ourselves part of one another, responsible to one another, responsible for ourselves and our families first, sure, but also responsible for our neighbors and our communities, and by extension, as one massive community, and no, I'm not a communist, but as one massive community, we would actually function in a way that has not been seen in many, many lifetimes. And it would be a unique revolution of the human species if we could simply make this adjustment. And, yeah, I'm just nuts, and I must have smoked some bad marijuana at some point, apparently. That's what I'm told. But, I think there's a spiritual understanding that needs to be had here. And we do have another hour coming up, and we're going to run out of time on this hour shortly and take a break. But when we do, I want to really explore that with you in the second hour. I mean, anything you want to talk about, I'm happy to do. But this is one of those key points where actually, when I was talking to you off the air, you started articulating that which I know to be true, but I cannot find a way to give a voice to it. And I find a way to speak about many subjects, but this is one of those things that I cannot seem to relate adequately to people to get them to wrap their minds around. And I really want to do this with you. So,
when we come back, I'll show you and your audience why Christ was an anarchist. And he says so, actually, in the text. And the most common form of government throughout the history of mankind has been anarchy, which doesn't have anything to do with chaos. It doesn't even have to do with not having a leader. You mentioned not having a leader. They had leaders in anarchy. They did not have rulers. There's a difference. In other words, that we had people who would come up and lead society, but people got the opportunity of choosing to follow or not on a day-to-day basis. And that's the difference. Anarchy is without rulers. You rule over yourself. And Israel was an anarchy, believe it or not, in the early days. But by the time Jesus came along, the people were doing something directly opposite of what Moses said. And they thought they were in the right, and they were wrong. And Christ pointed this out, and we'll talk about that and show you why Christ was an anarchist when we come back.
Absolutely. I'm telling you right now, guys, you got to stay tuned for this, because it's going to change the way that you view things. This has been, I'm telling you, I've been looking for somebody to help me explain this, because it is part of the reality that if you change your actions and you change your intent, that which you kind of put out into the world does come back to you and does change the world. I know everybody thinks it's a crazy idea to talk about, you know, the butterfly flapping his wings in China. But the truth is that each one of your actions and each one of the words that you choose to speak is literally like an invocation. Okay, you invoke many things by your actions. You invoke many things by your treatment of other living beings, by your treatment of the environment, by your treatment of yourself, by your treatment of your family. All of these things have a resonant effect. Okay, and even if it is one voice alone echoing in the world, what happens when a choir begins to sing is you end up with a very full and very textured, well-traveling, wondrous sound. Okay, I know, craziness, why are we going to get everybody to sort of behave in a wholly different way? That means that, you know, there's no longer any benefit to exploiting one another, which to me, recent history has been nothing but a continuous chain of exploitation. Very much like Brother Gregory was talking about bondage, I do believe that not only didn't we abolish slavery in this country, but the plantation was expanded, okay, when they allegedly abolished slavery. But I think that that has been a continuous thing that has occurred through the, well, the mechanism of contracts, through the mechanism of deception, through the mechanism of taking away the intent of one's words and actions, ascribing them to someone else, diluting responsibility. All of these things are relevant. But what happens is when you change the way that you conduct yourself and you change the way others conduct themselves, it is possible to have that true ripple effect. After all, we are quite a bit a large component water. So think about it. If you drop the right pebble into the pond, eventually you may create a tsunami that doesn't have to destroy things. Well, maybe it destroys things that it needs to, but it doesn't have to sweep away all life like we see these things doing now on the planet on occasion. And I do agree that we're looking at a collapse, which is upcoming. because it's an absolute certainty. When you examine the parallels of history and you understand that it repeats itself, all of that is true as well. But I think we're going to go into some brand new territory in the second hour with Brother Gregory Williams. And I'm telling you, we'll point out the websites, the books, and everything else later on. But stay around, because this one's going to be a little different on the Ocelli Effect. I promise you that much. Stick around, guys, and we'll be right back.
American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Provide us for free education?
Well, that's obviously effective, but apart from reversing the dumbing down of America...
All the information they provide is free?
What about the free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, man?
Exploiting commonplace corruption?
They help vulnerable people who don't have a voice?
Bringing light to important information nobody else does. Or they never censor, hang up, or cut off their guests?
Well, that's not fun, is it?
Oh, they created a fantastic alternative media source during an era of bad, manipulative, and infiltrated mainstream and alternative media shills and scum.
Okay, well, apart from the free education, free information, free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, exposing commonplace corruption, helping vulnerable people without a voice, bringing light to important information nobody else does, and creating a fantastic commercial-free alternative media source in a sea of bad, manipulative, mainstream, and alternative media shills and scum, what has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Donate to American Freedom Radio today.
Welcome to the world's meeting place. American.
Practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. HempUSA.org introduces 3 brand new detox formulations of micro plant powder. Brain Fuel for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
I have this feeling, man, because you know there's a handful of people actually run everything. That's true. It's provable. Handful, very small elite run and own these corporations, which include the mainstream media. I have this feeling who's ever elected president, like Clinton was, no matter what your promises you promise on the campaign trail, blah, 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 when you win, you go into this smoky room with the 12 industrialists, capitalist scum f***s who got you in there, and you're in this smoky room, and this little film screen comes down. And a big guy in a cigar rolled a film. And it's a shot of a Kennedy assassination from an angle you've never seen before. That looks suspiciously off the grassy knoll. And then the film, the screen goes up and the lights come up and they go to the new president. Any questions? Just what my agenda is. First we bomb Baghdad. You got it.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio in service to the community with strength, wisdom, and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics, no taboo topics, no fear of doom, no fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio, American Freedom Radio.
Get ready for the Ocelli Effect. The most underrated voice in all media, the alternative, Chuck Ocelli.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect starts now here on American Freedom Radio at AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and we do thank you for giving us this time this evening. It is an interesting show. I'll tell you something. I get Skype messages a lot of times during the show, and right now what I'm receiving is Skype messages that are asking me why it is that I have this particular gentleman on, because usually I cover subjects that seem to be a little dangerous. Well, I assure you of this. This is actually, if you think about it carefully, probably one of the most dangerous subjects that we could possibly cover, because this would truly challenge every bit of authority you see on the planet, the direction we're about to go in right now. All of the authority which has been exercised, which is observable at this point in time, is to subjugate the individual. You are made subject by all sorts of regulations and contracts, as we sort of touched on in discussing marriage in the first hour. But what is the solution? Everybody always asks. It may sound rather bizarre, but if we change just one aspect of our behavior, and I would boil it all the way down to the truth about what is actually charity. Okay? And I know it sounds weird because, again, I'm not one of these guys who is religious. I all the time have this odd argument with individuals telling them, look, I don't call myself a Christian. And they seem to think that I have certain values that go right along with being a Christian, but I'm not a Christian per se. But here's the thing. This is a universal truth. So whatever it is you describe as the source, the universe, the God, the gods, I mean to tell you that this is one of those things which is universally self-evident if you examine it carefully, and extremely revolutionary in nature. So Brother Gregory is with me tonight, and I'll tell you something. I feel extremely privileged to have you on, although I got to be embarrassed and say that I'm not as familiar with your work as I wish I was. But beginning to examine some of your writing and some of the ideas that you've imparted and some of the reality which you've laid out rather concisely, it's really amazing, and I want to thank you for taking this time with us tonight, sir.
You're welcome.
But, you know, what do you think about what I just said here, though, about the concept of charity and how it is that that one very small word and the reality behind it, the real universal truth of it, if it were exercised properly, would really be a completely revolutionary thing that could affect, I mean, the entire planet?
Well, you know, I point out, I deal with charity all the time. That's really the business that the church is in, should be in. When I first began this, to even use the word church was difficult for me to do, because so many people have been misusing it for the last 100-200 years. If you went back 200 years ago, when the definition of religion was the performance of your duty, actually it says the pious performance of your duty, then you have to go back and find out what the word pious means, and that is your parental duty, to God and your fellow man. Well, what's your duty to God? God doesn't need any help from you. Your duty to God is to love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus said, seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And we know it's not righteous to take away from your neighbor so that you can benefit. That's either coveting or stealing or both. And what the early church was doing, what the church was doing in early America, as opposed to what you were seeing over in much of Europe, was they were taking care of all the social welfare needs of the people of America through charity, through free will offerings. You don't even find the word charity in the Old Testament anywhere in the translation. But you do find the phrase free will offering. Israel was a government. It had 10 laws, which were basically negative laws. Thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that. And right. Basically don't murder, don't steal, don't even covet your neighbor's goods. Don't want to take away from your neighbor. Today, everybody thinks it's okay to take away from your neighbor as long as you do it through government. But in Israel, you couldn't do it through government because there was no government that exercised authority one over the other. In Israel, everybody in early Israel, if the sacrifice, this will shock people, and we're not going to probably get a chance to get into this, but the altars of Moses, the altars even of Abraham, had nothing to do with piling up rocks and killing sheep and setting them on fire. The largest religious, most popular religious group at the time of Christ knew that there was no call to pile up rocks and set them on fire in the Old Testament. They read the Hebrew, they spoke Hebrew, and they knew that that wasn't the case. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, they were, and many of the Zealots, they thought you were supposed to pile up stones and set sheep on fire, and that was your sacrifice. But the same word in the Hebrew language for a gathering of men, of friends, specifically a gathering of friends, is a gathering of stones. And the offerings that you were to make, what they called korban, which means sacrifice, was given to these living stones in the early days of Israel. And they were freely given. They didn't call it charity because that's not the way we translate it. But the word means free will offering, which is what charity is. And they turned around and they gave the surplus of that giving to help the needy of their society. They were to serve, it says, the tabernacles of the congregation. The word tabernacle is tents of the congregation. That's like the households of the congregation. They were organized into a group of tens, hundreds, and thousands, 10, 50s, hundreds, and thousands. 10 families got together and picked a minister. They tied to that minister, this is the actual words it says in the Bible, tied to him according to his service. In other words, if he was helping take care of the widows and orphans and needy of their society, the true needy of their society, in a way that strengthened the poor, then people freely gave to him. His office, his governmental office, was an office of service. Mm. And he was only supported by free will offerings. Today, your religious leaders are the head of Social Security, the head of your welfare office. Those are the priests of your society. They do not wait for free will offerings. They force the offerings of the people. They are archists. They are men who exercise authority one over the other. Anarchists are people who don't have authority, that take care of the needy of your society and the needs of your society through free will offerings. The five times that it mentions religion in the Bible, four times they're talking about it in a bad way, bad religion. One time in the Bible, it talks about good religion. They call it pure religion. They say pure religion is visiting the widows and orphans. What do they mean by visiting? It means coming there and taking care of them, helping them if they need help. You know, your husband dies and you got 10 kids and they're going to all starve to death unless somebody helps. That's what the church was supposed to do. That's what the Levites were supposed to do. And they did it with free will offerings. Today, they don't go to church. They go to the government. Well, the government are these men who call themselves benefactors, but they exercise authority. They're archē. They're not anarchē. They're archē. That's the Greek word, archē, rulers. Anarchy is without rulers, not without leaders, because the Levites were leaders. They just couldn't exercise authority. They couldn't force the contribution. No Levites were kicking in doors and forcing you to contribute. They were doing a good job, and good people contributed to the work that they did. If they weren't doing a good job, they stopped contributing to those men of the government and contributed to men who would do a good job. Their offerings were votive offerings. They didn't vote somebody into power, and then he now forces people to contribute to his program. The majority of governments throughout the history of mankind were these voluntary systems. But you won't know that because you didn't go to a voluntary school. You went to public schools, and they've removed that from your history. Now, there are some scholars who are now coming out, Enterprise of Law. That's a book that's been written in the last 10 years, I think. And it tells you that the majority of governments throughout the history of mankind were voluntary systems, anarchies. Mm. They had leaders, but their leaders were titular. The word titular, that's what you'll find that in definitions of a republic 100 years ago. The leaders are titular, means in name only. They had no archē, no power to force you to contribute. They couldn't force you to go to war. They couldn't draft you. You had to choose to go and defend your neighbor. And so how did they do that? Well, the tens, hundreds, thousands, tens, that's what the Teutons use. We go through this in the book, Thy Kingdom Come. We show you the history of it. There was a story that I found amazing. All these stories come to me through books that people give me. I don't buy books. Can't afford it. I'm a very poor guy, sheep herder out on the desert. But if God wants me to read something, somebody will send me the book. And okay. I open it up. And here's the story in there. In 600 A.D., this is before the rise of the kings, which took place around 1066. There was somebody who was pretty rich, had a bunch of men who were employed by him as soldiers, and he started to oppress the people around about him, the villages round about, and tried to impose tribute taxes on these villages. And the news got out, and men from 1,000 miles away were marching towards this one guy who had a castle who was going out conquering villages around him. And they marched, and finally they saw this army coming from all these different directions. And they sent out ambassadors. And the ambassadors go out to try to talk to this army and say, hey, you know, what do you guys want? You know, I don't want to fight you. There's too many of you. And by this time, they're camped all around this guy's castle. And the ambassadors come back in, and they say they won't negotiate. And he says, well, what'd their leaders say? Well, you know, what'd their king say? And they said that there was no king. And he says, well, who'd you talk to? And he says, well, they have no leader. He says, they say they are all kings. And this is what the ambassador was coming back reporting. And the reason they were there is because they had friends, relatives, distant cousins who were being oppressed. And the news went out that somebody's trying to set up a kingdom where they rule men over other men. They didn't do this. Same thing in the Teutons. Rome went up there to try to defeat the Teutons with their legions, and 15,000 legionnaires came against 12,000 Teutons, and the Teutons defeated them to the man, and they had no king. to lead them. They were organized in the tens, hundreds, thousands. And this is the way the early church was for the first 1,000 years after Christ. And there were no kings, really. You hear reference to them, but if you actually study most of these people who said they were kings, they had no power to force people into battle. They had no power to control and tax people on their lands and in their homes and on their labor. We have been given a distorted view of history to justify the centralization of government. When the Bible, why were the early translators of the Bible persecuted, killed, set on fire, had their tongues cut out? Well, they began to understand, and this is what it said in the introduction to the Wycliffe Bible. Mm-hmm. This book is for the government of the people, for the people, and by the people. That's where Abraham Lincoln got that phrase. Because the Bible is about government. But now you go to your modern Christian, they don't understand what they're even reading. You go to the Pharisees at the time of Christ. They read the Old Testament, but they had twisted it to mean something else. But if you actually, you were talking before the break about if we just, everything that we do, everything that we think and say sets out a ripple in the universe that takes us and the people around us in a particular direction. Well, that's absolutely true. And you can look at it. I can show you this actually in quantum physics and string theory and all this kind of stuff. But what's happened is our collective consciousness has gotten into our head that it's okay to take away from our neighbors through the agency of governments that we create with our own hands. Mm. And that's a good thing. And it's actually taken us into the dark where now we are subject to destruction. Jesus said, not those who say, Lord, Lord, but those who doeth the will of the Father. The will of the Father is thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. Jesus said, you have seen the governments of the Gentiles who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority one over the other. That's arche. It is not to be that way with you. You're not to be arche. You're to be anarche, without rulers. You are to learn to live by faith, hope, and charity. Faith is what we call probity, or can be called probity. It's a conviction that you will not desire your neighbor's goods, your neighbor's labor, your neighbor's house, your neighbor's, anything that is your neighbor's, for your personal benefit. Mm. But today, people by the millions call themselves Christians, and that's why when you say you don't want to call yourself a Christian, I understand. Because what is calling themselves Christians today, they're going around in their churches saying they're praying and singing to Jesus and believe in Jesus. But when they need something, they go to the governments of the Gentiles who call themselves benefactors, and they seek those benefits, knowing that they are only provided by taking away from their neighbor. And now, because the government is in debt, they are taking away from your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren, because every benefit that is given away pushes us farther and farther into debt. And so that you curse your children. And that's what it says in the Bible. Peter says it. Through covetousness, you will become merchandise. You'll become possessions of your own government. You will, through covetous practices, he says, you will curse your children. That's what's happened. But we can change this. If we change, you can change the leader all you want. But if you don't change, and all you have to do is two or more people gather together with the intention of taking care of other people and their own family, like you said, but other people. But you get to exercise discretion in how you do that. You know, you have to use charity in a way that strengthens the poor. The sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was in a time of affluence. This is what it says in the Bible. I'm quoting right out of the Bible. In a time of affluence, they did not strengthen the poor. They took care of the poor. They provided for the poor, but not in a way that strengthened them. Look at Detroit. Look at Baltimore. Look at the black society. The blacks, if black lives matter, blacks should be working like the Dickens to get all blacks off welfare. In 1905, the average black family, I mean, the average children born out of wedlock in the black family was 1.5%. If you went to the cities, the percentage might rise, you know, like Chicago, might be 3% of the children were born out of wedlock with no birth control or anything like that around, but only 3% of the children were born out of wedlock, even in places like Chicago. Today, 75% of the children in the black community, 73 to 75%, are born out of wedlock. That's not the product of slavery, not involuntary servitude. It is the product of slavery. Socialism is slavery. It's the product of socialism that has destroyed the black community, destroyed their families, divided them as a community. I mean, most blacks are shot by blacks in domestic violence and drug-related cases. Mm. So if Black Lives Matter, blacks should be working hard to get blacks off of Social Security and not just Social Security, but welfare, any kind of welfare. And so what we promote is that people should gather together in this tens, hundreds, and thousands. I don't care about, you know, a lot of the modern dogmas that come out of the modern religions that have led people astray. Let's get down to the basics. Christ almost never gave specific instructions as to what to do and not to do. That's the doctrines of Christ, is what he said to do and not to do. He said, don't covet. When they asked him about eternal life, he says, thou knowest the commandments, keep them. If people aren't trying to do that, stop stealing, stop coveting your neighbor's goods, stop, you know, murdering your neighbor or hiring a government to murder your neighbor. If we don't stop that and change, and what this is what the early church was, it was organized in these tens, hundreds, and thousands. And I can show you that throughout history, which is why I wrote the book, Thy Kingdom Comes. I'll give you, go ahead.
See, here's the thing about this, right? I see it this way. That this is a universal truth, okay? And even if you know you're turned off by the idea that this is, you know, something biblical, and I do find the modern establishment of any organized religion at this point extremely repulsive. Not a single one does what they pretend to do. Nothing in this world seems to be labeled appropriately any longer. But here's the thing. I think that this can extend far beyond having a church or a priest who does that. That old structure, yeah, that worked. But I think that this could be done on an individual basis. I think that each and every individual, if motivated to do so, would actually reverse the tide of this decay based on just taking responsibility for what's immediately around them. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I feel like this is something that I don't know, again, how to explain, that if this was the great shift, everybody looks for, you know, what is the solution to all the problems? Literally speaking, this would eliminate the need to conduct not all war, but most war is really an extension of something which is covetous in your in your explanations here. There's always somebody coveting something, land, resources, et cetera, right? This is what the basis of all that is. The fact that rulers create certain decrees and, you know, make certain things legal and other things illegal. This causes black markets to rise up, which ends up being once again another destructive force. But it has all been set up that way because there is a lack of empathetic responsibility to your fellow man. I really feel that way. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, well, maybe you're, you know, again, just, you know, fell down the hippie hole, like I said. But I don't see it that way. I really do believe, by my own observation, that that no matter what you call it, if you can adapt to the idea that by taking care of one another, we would have no need to be oppressed by any of these systems, which we could identify, you know, piece by piece. We could talk about the banks. We could talk about the, you know, the societal pressures. We could talk about the subdivisions of cultures based on, you know, racial paranoias and fear of different, you know, practices and things like this. All of that really does disappear if you take an honest position of truly what would be charity, I guess, which again is really better defined. You know, the way you explained it was perfect. You know, that concept
That charity thing, you know, like I said, the only time it talked about religion in a good sense in the Bible was pure religion, which was visiting the widows and orphans. But it went on in the rest of that verse. It said, unspotted by the world. Now, this is why the meaning of words is very important. There are five different Greek words that are all translated into the single English word, world. And they're completely different Greek words. And they translate them into world, not always into world, but they, when you see the word world anywhere in the New Testament, you got to say, which word did they use there? Did they use ekumene? Did they use cosmos? Did they use aeon? There's five different ones that could be translated into world. And there's actually another one that could be translated into world, should be translated into world, and they never do. But anyway, the word that they use there, your pure religion, taking care of those needy of your society, unspotted by the world. It's not unspotted by the planet Earth. It's unspotted by the, and this is the definition of the word in the, even in the Greek concordance used by religious societies, constitutional order or system of government. In other words, you have to take care of the needy of your society. Without those archai guys, those men who exercise authority, those benefactors who exercise authority one over the other, they're not really benefactors. They just call themselves that, but they only give you what they take away from others. If you're not doing that, if you're not taking care of the needy of your society, unspotted by the world, you are neither religious, as the word used to be used at right. the time of the writing of the Bible. It wasn't religious like the Pharisees, which were repeating prayers and doing ceremonies and singing songs and all the things you see in the modern church. But it was actually taking care of communion. As today, if you go to most churches, communion is this little wafer of bread that they stick on your tongue. I can show you in accounts of the first century church, communion were sacks of bread given to people because there were famines going on. People were starving to death. 100,000 people in a town would that town would turn into a few thousand people in a matter of a month because of famine. Right away in the New Testament, you see a collection taken up to take care of a famine way outside of town, you know, to another city. You had people in Galatia sending stuff with Paul to take care of people down in I think it was the other way around, Corinth through Galatia. But the point was, is this tens, hundreds, and thousands. We have this discussion in our network, and people can join the network as they go to preparingyou.com, which is one of our websites. Another one is hisholychurch.org, and you can look up network, and you can join the network. But these congregations of 10, you can't be a member. You're not. You don't sign up and become some sort of person that is legally bound to anything. These are free assemblies. Mm. These are where you have the right to freely assemble. You don't have to pay anything. You don't have to give anything, except if you choose to. And these are there were two kinds of altars in the Old Testament: altars of stone and altars of earth. The word they use there for earth is Adama. You're an altar of earth. You're walking, breathing, thinking, in most cases, some cases maybe not thinking, piles of dirt. That's what we are. We're earth, Adama. And we gather together in these piles of earth, these mounds, and we are living altars. That's what they were talking about. And they were taking care of one another in society, so much so that when an entire army marches in, takes Sodom, takes Gomorrah, takes numerous city-states, just overcomes those city-states. Now, those city-states were operating the way that your modern governments operate, with rulers, archites, kings. But Abraham's out there. He's not doing that. He's setting up altars, that, in other words, these systems of charity, where you were organized in your charity, but you were still choosing to do it on a personal basis. You didn't have to give anything in. And you were doing it on an intimate basis. You know, you can't be intimate with a 500-man congregation. You go to these giant mega churches, 1,000 people there. People, next week, some of those people will be dead in their apartments and nobody will even know, because they're not real churches. The real church, you don't show up. It's the buddy system times 10. But it also was, there were the vast migrations during the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Whole areas would become diseased and people would have to flee, or they'd be invaded, or they'd just run out of food and they would have to go somewhere else. The fall of Jerusalem, the Christians came out of the fall of Jerusalem singing. They had to leave everything behind. But they were singing because they had a place to go, because they were a part of this network of charity. But it was true charity. It wasn't people forcing one another to give anything. The leaders were not men who exercised authority. They were an anarchy. They were leaders in charity. They were given to because they were doing the job of taking care of one another unspotted by the world. The early Christians were persecuted, and I show in articles we have for free, you can just go read them on preparingyou.com, the Christian conflict. Christians were being persecuted because they wouldn't join the mandatory health care system, the mandatory social security system, the mandatory welfare system of the day. They wouldn't join that because that was of the world. That was of the constitutional order and system of Rome. They had to take care of one another through faith, hope, and charity. They wrote letters. We still have those letters to the Emperor of Rome, Antoninus Pius, sent there by Justin. And he says, this is the way we do it. We gather every week. And those that have share with those that don't have enough.
Mm.
That's how we do it.
Hang on just a second, because I'll tell you what. There's been a bunch of phone callers who have tried to get through during the course of this show.
Okay.
And I have one that's been hanging on the line. I do want to get you on, caller. And anybody else who wants to call in, the number is 218-339-8525. I didn't even give out the number today. But 218-339-8525. If you want to, we're down to like the last half hour already. Amazing how fast this time has gone. But 218-339-8525. If you want to ask a question, make a comment, I'll try and get everybody in who calls. And there you go, because this is just extremely thought-provoking to me that what we see today does not represent even remotely what the initial intent was, you know. And I find that throughout all things that history has in fact been hijacked, that the intent of just about every structure on the planet has been hijacked, that nothing is labeled appropriately anywhere, whether it's food, religion, it doesn't really matter. It all has a label on it, which is contradictory to its contents. And even people that label themselves, I used to get myself in trouble for saying this, but I am really sick and tired of encountering Christians. I would like to see some more people that are Christ-like, because I could get along a lot better in a world that was full of more of those people. I find this an extremely valid subject to discuss. So, like I said, 218-339-8525, and I will add you into the discussion. But, you know, Brother Gregory, also, by the way, one more thing before I do forget and we wind up running right out of time. Yes, hisholychurch.org, if you start there, there are a great many tabs where you can find a lot of different information. There's all sorts of websites that relate to your work, articles. There's actually a radio network. There's all kinds of things. But I think if you start at His Holy Church, all words together and spelled out just like they sound, .org, if you start there, I think this would be a place to begin to get more information about Brother Gregory, his writings, and really the entire concept, which I was under the opinion that it did, no longer existed, to be honest with you, that it was a study in ancient history to examine this concept, that it was long forgotten. You know, I'm not so thrilled with modern times as regular listeners of this show might know, because everything just is a mass deception and a game which is being played in order to subjugate other individuals. And I often say that that those who profit on the blood of others are quite a bit the enemy of anything that I have in myself in any way, shape, or form. So I am opposed to anyone who does that, and that does include those who would choose to steal in one way or another from one. I'm not thrilled with the Robin Hood concept of stealing from someone to give to another, but to encourage someone who does have more than they require in the world to contribute to their fellow man, whether that be through knowledge, whether that be through a giving of the excess of material goods, it really doesn't matter. All of these things, and that's another thing, by the way, you know, it's not all about necessarily giving food and clothing and shelter all the time, but knowledge, enlightenment, instruction of all sorts should be freely and, given as well. I think that this is also an act of charity, because think about this for a moment. You say, you know, that to do these things, to take care of your fellow man and to strengthen the poor, not to just give to them, but to actually strengthen them. And those that might be poor may not be just poor in a material sense, but in an emotional sense, in a spiritual sense, in a intellectual sense. I think that it's incumbent upon us as human beings to give away the gifts that we have encountered for ourselves if we find that we have more than we require to take care of ourselves and our families. I think it's that's why that excess exists. I think that's the way it is. I mean, again, it's a strange view of the world, I know, but that's how I feel about it. And I want to let you keep speaking, by the way, and I will get to that one caller who's been hanging on a while, but anybody else who wants to get in, one more time, 218-339-8525, and I'll get to everybody that I can. Sorry, Brother Gregory. I just wanted to throw that in there. I thought it was necessary.
Oh, that's all right. It's your show. So, did you want to take the caller? Or?
Well, yeah, I could do that. Let's just do that, actually. You know, I never plan anything. It's sort of like, let's see how it presents itself, and I'll take it from there. You know, I allow the gods to dictate what it is that's placed in front of me, because I don't have the power to make a lot of these choices. you know what I mean? So yeah. Here we go. 505 area code. You're on the air. 505 area code. You're on the air with Brother Gregory. Oh, wow. He might have fallen asleep there on hold. All right. I'll put you back on hold. And look, I had him on hold for a long time, so I'll come back to you, 505 area code, but I'd like to continue on with this discussion, though, and give people a chance because there's a little delay in the broadcast, so it might take them a few minutes to get back on the board. There were a few people that dropped off before, so I want to give them all a chance to call back in. But, you know, what do you think about that as well, though? It's not just limited to the worldly possessions and the sharing of wealth.
Yes. The Bible says in Proverbs, as many as I love, I also rebuke. In other words, probably there isn't anything more important. If you see somebody doing something that's going to cause them trouble, problems, it's going to injure them, make them sick, and you don't tell them, how can you say you love them? Even though when you tell them, you know they might hate you for it. You still have to tell them, and that of course is what I'm doing. You know, I'm not against the churches that are out there now. I'm for the truth. The churches that are out there, the religionists that are out there, I don't care if they're Buddhist or Christian or whatever. This all goes for them too. If you're coveting your neighbor's goods, you want your rights back. You have to start caring about the rights of others. If you want, the reason people are in bondage today, the reason that there are totalitarian governments all around the world, and it's getting worse and worse and worse, is because we have been coveting our neighbor's goods. We've been taking away from our neighbor. I mean, Proverbs says, if you sit and eat with a ruler, and you be a man of appetite, put a knife to your throat, for he serves you deceitful meat. They're deceitful dainties. What's he talking about? He's talking about, you know, you can go to Plutarch. The greatest destroyers of liberty are the givers of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. That's 2,000-year-old philosopher. We can go to Polybius, before him, who is telling about Rome was starting down this road of social welfare, and it was turning the people into monsters, savages. In the Old Testament, they talk about, we build us a city, and the city be the cauldron, and we be the flesh. And it goes on to talk about taking a bite out of one another. New Testament says the same thing. Be careful you do not bite one another, lest ye be devoured. That's New Testament. What are they talking about? Every time you want a benefit at the expense of your neighbor, you're taking a bite out of your neighbor. Mm. And this is going to mean that you're going to be devoured. Proverbs talks about if sinners entice thee and say, let's all have one purse, then they warn you that the net is spread before the bird and he's still captured. He says, you're going to be captured if you lurk privately for the blood of others. What is it? These are symbols. They're talking about socialism. Today we have candidates for president, the office of president in the United States. They're openly socialists, even communists, and they're praised and almost revered. Yet 50 years ago, it would have been unthinkable in America. Our minds are being changed because of our deeds. You know,
there's an interesting point because I got to be honest with you. I find myself less repulsed by the likes, because you're referring to Bernie Sanders in a way here right now, I think, directly. Okay, and maybe you don't want to get into this discussion, but I got to tell you something. I find myself completely, on the outside of the political process. I don't feel a need to participate in something that doesn't represent me or ever operate in my best interest, so I don't participate, but I do have these discussions.
I'm actually on your side with that. I know there is no political solution. I'm not advocating a political solution. I'm just, you know, it's like the guys who are out there, you know, discussing some judge just ruled, I think it was in Michigan or something, that if a boy, teenage boy, 17, 18 years old, feels like a girl, he can use the girl's locker room because he feels like a girl today.
And oh, yeah, that's another subject. But
the reality is, how did we get to the point where that's even discussed?
I'm
old enough to remember that if that was even discussed or brought up, somebody would have put a straitjacket on you. Now they're wearing black robes and they're saying it, and the people at the school are saying, oh, yeah, we have to do that. No consideration of the girls and what they feel like, just what this one guy feels like.
Well, right. But when you come down to it, right, I looked at this whole thing where people said to me, you know, look, if you thought for a moment that your vote counted, which is, you know, a vow, and I don't really want to take a vow to anyone, but if you thought for a moment your vote counted, and you were going to vote for one of these presidential candidates, which one would you go for? And I got a hell of a backlash, excuse me for saying that, but I did, for saying that, well, you know who's the least repulsive of them is this Bernie Sanders. And they're like, but he's a socialist. And I say, yeah, he's a socialist, but they all are, really. They don't call themselves that, but they all are. And at the very least, he would be talking about, turning around and taking the money that they're going to steal from us anyway, and at least putting it to some use among the people he took it from. Which is,
unfortunately, his plans will not strengthen the poor.
No, they won't. But they, at the very least, it would be in more of a correct direction. To my estimation, and this is a weird sort of state to be in, because a few years ago, if you would have asked me, I would have thought it was crazy. But the fact is that I find that a whole lot less repulsive than these other guys who want to spend the treasury away and spend trillions of dollars to basically, by extension, murder people that I'll never see and will never set foot on in this country. I mean, that to me is a whole lot more repulsive than, say, building more social welfare. But
yeah, so ultimately what the choice that most everybody has today is the choice of supposedly the lesser of two evils.
My caution with that is, and here's the thing, and I'll shut up after I say this. I'll let you go at it. But the thing is, you look at it as, well, the lesser of two evils is this, and the lesser of two evils is that. At least with this guy, I'll get to keep my guns. At least with this guy, you know. And I say to myself, you know what? This is why I make no selection whatsoever, willfully, because even though I'm selecting the lesser of two evils, or the lesser of five evils, or whatever it is you want to call it, even though it's all part of the same system in my estimation, guess what? You're still selecting and advocating some power to an evil, regardless of what
right.
it is.
You know, here, Samuel 8. Samuel 8 in the Bible, which you'll never probably ever hear in a modern church.
Okay.
That's it says in there that the people wanted a leader who literally could exercise authority. They said, give us a king who can, you know, actually they were looking for a commander-in-chief who would fight our battles for us. And they were actually having problems with their common law courts where people were taking bribes. Now, there was a way in which to deal with that, but they wanted to have somebody who could exercise authority. So Samuel gives his famous speech to the people saying, you know, first he goes to God and he says, God, what am I supposed to do? And God says, it's not because they've rejected you, Samuel. It's because they've already rejected me that they want this leader who can fix things for them. And he uses that word, they've already rejected me. He says that. And he says, but tell them what they're going to get if they go this way. And he says, he's going to take the first fruits of your labor. He's going to take the best of your fields. He's going to appoint men to rule over you. He says, there's like six or seven. He's going to take and take and take and take and take. And eventually you're going to cry out because he's going to take so much. But then God says, but I'm not going to hear you in that day. Why? Because the reason he's taking is because you've all coveted your neighbor's goods. You've all wanted this stuff at the expense of your neighbor, which is the antithesis of loving your neighbor, is to wanting to take away from your neighbor. This is pervasive throughout modern religion. They all do this. There's a few. I mean, like the Amish, you know, they're exempt from Obamacare, automatically exempt from Obamacare from the beginning, because they already take care of one another. I don't want everybody to become Amish because they're kind of a sectarian group, but they have some good ideas. They do
but
take care of one.
That's the thing, is because they're completely removed from the situation entirely.
They've learned to do
it
without it.
Yeah.
Right. The early Christians were doing that. That's what they were doing. The early Christians were learning to do without. See, you know, most people don't know that, and this will shock a lot of your listeners, that Herod was sending people out to baptize people into the kingdom of God, in the kingdom of heaven, as they would use the word Ouranos in the Greek, before John the Baptist was. He was sending people out to baptize people into the kingdom of heaven, you know, the whole dunk them in water thing. And it was a tradition that came all the way from the days of Moses when they were at the foot of Mount Sinai, where they were all washing up. Now, what was he really doing? This is the thing. Is nobody knows what they were doing in these pagan temples and why they had a golden calf. There's an actual reason why they did these things. It wasn't just superstition. It wasn't like Cecil B. DeMille's in the movie Moses. What he was doing was setting up a social welfare system where you signed up and you were registered, and he would give you a white stone with a numerical value on it, because the Hebrew letters have numerical values, and you were registered, and you had to pay in a portion of what you produced every year into his treasury, and they would take care of the widows and orphans, and even your parents. He would take care of your parents, and this was in the system they called Corban. Corban is the Hebrew word for sacrifice. Romans had a Corban system, too. They spelled it different, Q-O-R-B-A-N. But it was their system of social welfare. But it was originally in Rome, it was free will offering. But by the time Augustus Caesar came along, and then with Tiberius and then Caligula, it was becoming compelled offerings. And you had to pay in. And this was what they called threskia, religion. It was how you took care of the needy of your society. But it was compelled now. John the Baptist was out there, and he was baptizing people, but he had to go out to the desert because they wanted to kill him. You know, that's why I'm out in the desert, because when they start hearing what I have to say, there will be people who want to kill me. But anyway, he was saying, they asked him, he says, what's this baptism thing that you're doing, John? And because they knew what baptism was, but they want to know what you're doing, John. He says, if you have two coats and your neighbor doesn't have a coat, share. Do the same with meats. This is his instructions. That's the instructions of John the Baptist concerning baptism. Yeah, but nobody tells you that. They tell you, oh, he dunked them in water. Why was he dunking them in water? Because he was organizing the tens, hundreds, and thousands, and these people were agreeing to live by charity. Like what you're saying. That's what the message of the gospel is. We should be doing all this stuff you're doing by men like Herod and Augustus Caesar, but we should be doing it by charity. That's the gospel. But nobody's doing that. They're out there singing and they're going to their churches and but if they need anything, they go to men who they call benefactors, but are really men who exercise authority. Which is the antithesis of what Christ is. You know, I've sat in front of whole rooms full of ministers, and I've asked them, what did Jesus list as the weightier matters? And this is in all the Bibles. They say it there. They translate it, the weightier matters. He lists them off. And he was condemning the Pharisees for their system of Corban. The Corban of the Pharisees was making the Word of God to none effect. Why? Because their sacrifice wasn't free will sacrifices anymore. Weren't free will offerings. They were compelled by tax collectors. They had to pay in. And why did they have to pay in? Because they made a contract. They signed up. Social Security is a contract. Now, you have to have a Social Security number now to even survive in this world today. You have to have that number.
Absolutely. Listen, we're going to run right out of time here, but
okay.
I want to say to people again, you know, we got to have more of these conversations because I'm telling you, we didn't even scratch the surface of what we could have tonight. And but I want to get into this further. In fact, we may devote an entire discussion one night to the concept of Corbin, what it actually means. Once again, I know it'll sound a little repetitious, but I think if we break it down for people and get them to understand it a little bit better, it'll change things in a way. So hisholychurch.org, go there as a starting point, guys. And please do look up Brother Gregory. I'm not saying that every single thing that that you said tonight is something that I would agree with, but it's a great starting point for changing things if you're tired of looking at the world the way it is. So, Brother Gregory, I appreciate calling you brother because I think of every man as my brother, so I'm happy to call you Brother Gregory. And I thank you for taking this time with us tonight on the Ocelli Effect, sir.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll do this again, guys. Stay tuned to American Freedom Radio. Not sure what's up next, but it'll be something interesting. The Ocelli Effect is done. Take care of yourselves and one another. Have a good night, guys.
I'm telling you. You gotta support American Freedom Radio because this government is getting out of hand. Wall Street won't launder my money. The CIA are cutting into my drug running and my gun running. Big Pharma's psychotropic drugs are making my customers commit suicide before my hitman can even whack them. And then they get depressed and get prescribed psychotropic drugs and commit suicide too. They're trying to become the biggest game in town. When you pay them protection money, you don't even get protected. I got unpaid taxes, and if I can't find the money, the IRS are gonna take my jobs. I got a mandatory flu vaccine, and now I'm autistic. I reported a vaccine reaction, and the doctor told me to forget about it. What have I ever done to have them treat me so disrespectfully? There's only one way to get the government off our backs, and that's to support American Freedom Radio. Capiche? So what are you gonna do? You're gonna go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and give them some legal tender they can't refuse.
News and information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom, freedom, American Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
What is the big deal about swearing to God in the first place? Why does swearing to God mean you're going to tell the truth? Wouldn't affect me. If they said to me, you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you, God, I'd say, yeah. I'll tell you about as much truth as the people who wrote that Bible. How do you like that? Huh? Swearing to God is kid stuff. Swearing to God doesn't mean anything. Swearing on the Bible doesn't mean anything. You know why? Because Bible or no Bible, God or no God, if it suits their purposes, people are going to lie in court. The police do it all the time. All the time. Yes, they do. It's part of their job to protect, to serve, and to commit perjury whenever it supports the state's case. Swearing on the Bible is just one more way of controlling people and keeping them in line, and it's one more thing that holds us back as a species.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio in service to the community with strength, wisdom and loyalty. The founders of AFI wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Vaccine, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules. No rules. No taboo topics.
No taboo topics.
No fear of doom.
No fear of doom.
We are
American Freedom Radio.
American Freedom Radio.